ticked near 5% the network value of Ethereum. The site for Ethereum Classic defines the crypto asset as a continuation of the original Ethereum blockchain, the classic version preserving untampered history, free from external interference and subjective tampering of transactions. While the DAO may have been a disaster, the concept of a decentralized autonomous organization is generalizable past the single instance. The innovative investor should expect to see similar concepts coming to market over the years with their own crypto tokens, and should know that not all DAOs or DApps with crypto tokens are similarly shaky. For example, a fully functional decentralized insurance company, Airbnb, or Uber all hold great promise, and developer teams are working on similar use cases. One can think of an Airbnb or Uber as a middleman, connecting the consumer and provider of a service, and then taking a 20 to 30% fee for doing so. While many merchants understandably complain about credit card fees of 2 to 3%, the platform fees of Airbnb, Uber, and similar platform services are borderline egregious. Many of the crypto token systems that are imitating such platforms plan to take a fee that is an order of magnitude less, using underlying blockchain architectures to facilitate the decentralized transfer of value and services. Many of these systems have their own crypto tokens and will run on Ethereum or a similar platform. However, some will be much better constructed than others, and it is unlikely that Ethereum, or platforms like it, will help DApps in future debacles. Decentralized platforms to predict the future. One of the more interesting DApps in development uses Ethereum's blockchain to facilitate prediction markets. The company Augur seeks to provide a platform that allows users to wager on the results of any event, creating a market for people to test their predictions. Hence, the term prediction market. For instance, if someone had sought to predict whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton would win the 2016 U.S. presidential election, he or she could have used Augur to create a prediction market and wager against others on the outcome, if the service had been up and running at the time. Augur uses a crypto token which it calls reputation, rep, to incentivize people to report on the outcomes of events truthfully. These reporters are different from the people wagering on the outcome of events. The problem with the decentralized prediction market is that there's no centralized authority on the outcome of events. Augur uses rep to reward people who report truthfully and penalize those who lie. Augur explains it as follows. Those who hold reputation are expected to report accurately on the outcome of randomly selected events within Augur every few weeks. If holders fail to report accurately on the outcome of an event or attempt to be dishonest, the Augur system redistributes the bad reporter's reputation to those who have reported accurately during the same reporting cycle. Augur conducted its own crowdfunding effort in 2015, selling 80% of a fixed supply of 11 million rep. In so doing, it raised over $5 million to fund the creation of the platform. Brian Armstrong, CEO of Coinbase, which is one of the largest companies in the crypto asset sector, has called it an awesome project with huge potential. Even Vitalik Buterin acknowledged its potential when he called it an Uber for knowledge. Augur is one of the clearest uses of crypto tokens, and its potential success could set the stage for even more implementations of crypto tokens in the future. A similar prediction market system, Gnosis, held a crowd sale in April 2017, raising money at an implied valuation north of $300 million. A growing web of crypto commodities and crypto tokens. While Ethereum has a robust community building on it, several similar platforms have taken note of its success. The aforementioned Definity, Lisk, Rootstock, Tezos, and Waves, as of writing, all are at different stages of development, between pre-crowd sale to already operating in the wild, and offer their own variations of a decentralized world computer. Rootstock, similar to Counterparty, intends to run on Bitcoin. Rootstock is led by Sergio Lerner, who specialized in IT security for much of his life, and when he first came to Bitcoin, audited many aspects of the code. He now leads a team that is basically building Ethereum on Bitcoin, and the system will be compatible with all dApps that run on Ethereum. Just as Ethereum has Ether, Rootstock will have its own native currency, called RSK. While some posit that Rootstock will be a significant competitor to Ethereum, we think the two will coexist and provide healthy redundancy. Having two or more widely recognized decentralized world computers to run on will make dApps more resilient to disruptions. If one network is experiencing severe trouble, then a dApp can replicate its state on another similar platform, and from then on process all transactions through that platform. While the transition would likely induce harrowing market volatility, such optionality means that dApps are not beholden to the platforms they build upon. Lastly, at the risk of confusing the innovative investor, we should add that a dApp may use many crypto commodities simultaneously, but for different infrastructural purposes. For example, a dApp may use a decentralized cloud storage system like Filecoin to store large amounts of data, and another crypto commodity for anonymized bandwidth, in addition to using Ethereum to process certain operations. For such bleeding-edge platforms, it is most important for the innovative investor to keep track of developer mindshare and miner support. Both are vital to the long-term growth and survival of these platforms. Developers will quickly iterate and fix bugs, while miners will provide the hardware and resources necessary to computationally secure the platform. Since these are decentralized systems operating in the wild, they need to move fast and be properly secured. Only then will other developers build dApps on them. Now that the innovative investor has an understanding of what these assets are, we want to move into why that investor should consider placing them in his or her investment portfolio. Although crypto assets are creating a rapidly evolving and somewhat complex future, investment tenets that have stood the test of time still apply. Returning to the fundamentals of investment theory will allow innovative investors to properly position their overarching portfolio to take advantage of the growth of crypto assets responsibly. Part 2. Why? Chapter 6. The importance of portfolio management and alternative assets. Jack was a columnist at MarketWatch.com in August 2013 when I made the logical leap to add Bitcoin to my portfolio. While initially born of curiosity, my interest in Bitcoin had grown more mature and serious with each passing month. As a writer focused on retirement, I decided that I could only recommend the asset to others if I had the courage to put it in my own retirement portfolio. Not only did I decide to invest in Bitcoin, I decided to place the entirety of that year's allocation for my Simplified Employee Pension, SEP plan, into Bitcoin. When I announced what I had done in my article, "Do Bitcoins Belong in Your Retirement Portfolio?" it created a stir online and in the financial planning community. My writing over the years had consistently discussed the need to remain prudent when making investment decisions, rationally building portfolios that balanced risks and returns. A balanced approach to investing grew from my experience as a financial consultant. I come from a background of not only working within companies in the financial community, but also from nearly a decade of working directly with regular investors who are trying to accomplish their financial goals and objectives. I have sat around hundreds of kitchen tables with my clients and near clients, explaining my belief that their personal dreams of retirement, or sending their children to college, could be accomplished by following a discipline of saving and proper asset allocation. I believe in the power of building a prudent portfolio based upon the needs and risks of each individual client. To some, my decision to invest in Bitcoin flew in the face of my own advice. I may have managed portfolios in a prudent manner for myself and others, but my interest in new technologies in the past made me no stranger to criticism. During the dot-com days, I made and lost a sizable amount of money investing in companies that flew high in terms of valuation, only to crash on the shores of reality as they were little more than business facades. Was I chasing a similar crash-and-burn scenario with Bitcoin? Even my technologically and investment-savvy son, Eric, initially criticized me about Bitcoin. "They have these things called dollar bills, Dad. Stick to using those." However, I saw real potential in the virtual currency. Over the months I spent evaluating it, I analyzed Bitcoin the same way I analyzed every other asset I added to my own or a client's portfolio, just as I had done over the last 30 years. I carefully considered and quantified Bitcoin's market behavior using the tools that follow, so I knew what beast I was dealing with. I ruminated on the percentage of my portfolio I could responsibly allocate to it, with the overarching goal of sensible asset allocation among stocks, bonds, and alternative assets. Then, I investigated the mechanics of putting Bitcoin into a retirement account. The overall process of analyzing an asset was the same. I'd done it countless times before. The only difference this time was that it was Bitcoin. Modern Portfolio Theory. When evaluating any investment decision, the starting point is always an individual's financial goals, time horizon, and risk tolerance. Goals are what the funds will be used for, and the time horizon reveals when they will be used. Risk tolerance takes a bit more analysis. Each investor has a unique tolerance for the ongoing gyrations of the value of his or her portfolio. For example, do people lose sleep when their portfolio fluctuates? Or do they slumber through ups and downs, dreaming of long-term gains? Once goals, time horizon, and risk tolerance are determined, one can proceed to developing an investment portfolio that maximizes returns while staying within the bounds of these parameters. Nobel Prize winner Harry Max Markowitz defined an approach to constructing portfolios in 1952 that has been the model that most advisors and investors have followed since. His Nobel Prize-winning effort created Modern Portfolio Theory, MPT, which provides for the construction of investment portfolios that maximize expected returns based upon a targeted level of risk. His efforts showed that higher returns are achieved by taking on higher risk, while also recognizing what he called an efficient frontier, which defines the maximum possible expected return for a given level of risk. The key for any investor employing MPT is to explicitly consider risk. While risk is not a palatable thought for retail investors, many of whom prefer to dream of risk-free million-dollar returns, there can be no reward without risk. The Securities and Exchange Commission, which regulates securities markets in the United States, has this advice about risk for investors. When it comes to investing, risk and reward are inextricably entwined. You've probably heard the phrase, "no pain, no gain." Those words come close to summing up the relationship between risk and reward. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. All investments involve some degree of risk. If you intend to purchase securities, such as stocks, bonds, or mutual funds, it's important that you understand before you invest that you could lose some or all of your money. The reward for taking on risk is the potential for a greater investment return. We'll tackle the specifics of quantifying risk shortly, mainly through a discussion of volatility. Similarly, we will dive into how to approach absolute returns and the returns per unit of volatility, or risk-reward ratio. While it's vital to understand the individual attributes of each asset in a portfolio, MPT goes beyond single assets to emphasize a holistic approach to the risks and returns of the overall portfolio. The same can be said of how a coach approaches any team. Understanding the strengths and weaknesses of each team member is important, but it's more important to understand how the team members play together. Great teams can be composed of average players, while a disjointed combination of great players can make average teams. Markowitz's efficient frontier, which maximizes returns for a given level of risk, is reached by smartly combining assets in a portfolio. A savvy combination of assets can actually decrease the risk of the portfolio to a lower level than any single asset in the portfolio, other than risk-free issues, which is one of the areas in which crypto assets become particularly noteworthy. We will return to how an investor can craft such a portfolio after we outline the three core characteristics of individual assets. Standard deviation. Standard deviation of returns, or the range that an asset's price will vary from its mean value, is one of the most common measures of risk. While Markowitz's approach makes clear the need for risk in a portfolio, most investors are risk-averse to one degree or another, and so they must be compelled by the potential for increased reward if they are to increase their risk. To help with the anxiety of risk, MPT defines it quantitatively, removing much of the uncertainty. Typically, simply being well-informed lets investors sleep better at night. The standard deviation of returns draws from the statistics of normal bell curves. If the average value, or mean, of a bell curve is 10, and its standard deviation is 5, then 68% of the time a randomly chosen entity from the sample will fall between 5 and 15. 5 is one standard deviation to the left of 10, and 15 is one standard deviation to the right of 10. Due to the way normal curves work, 95% of the time a random sample will fall within two standard deviations of the mean, so between 0 and 20 for our example. For example, take a stock that has an expected return, mean, of 7%, and a 5% standard deviation of expected returns. There is a 68% probability that this stock will yield returns between 2 and 12% in the upcoming year. With a less aggressive asset, say a bond that has an expected return of 4% and standard deviation of 1%, then 68% of the time it can be expected to yield between 3 and 5% in the coming year. There is less potential for both upside and downside with the bond, whereas the stock has much more potential for some great years, but also the potential risk of seriously dreary years. Hence, the standard deviation of expected returns informs investors of the amount of risk they're taking if they were to hold only that asset. For a more holistic view, compare a portfolio with a standard deviation of returns of 4% to one that has a standard deviation of 8%. If both portfolios have the same expected return of 7%, it wouldn't be a prudent decision to invest in the portfolio with more volatility, as they both have the same expected return. Taking on a higher level of risk has no benefit in this light, and if a portfolio is unwisely constructed, investors can end up taking on more risk than they're compensated for. Sharpe ratio. Similar to the concepts behind MPT, the Sharpe ratio was also created by a Nobel Prize winner, William F. Sharpe. The Sharpe ratio differs from the standard deviation of returns in that it calibrates returns per the unit of risk taken. The ratio divides the average expected return of an asset, minus the risk-free rate, by its standard deviation of returns. For example, if the expected return is 8% and the standard deviation of returns is 5%, then its Sharpe ratio is 1.6. The higher the Sharpe ratio, the better an asset is compensating an investor for the associated risk. An asset with a negative Sharpe ratio is punishing the investor with negative returns and volatility. Importantly, absolute returns are only half the story for the Sharpe ratio. An asset with lower absolute returns can have a higher Sharpe ratio than a high-flying asset that experiences extreme volatility. For example, consider an equity asset that has an expected return of 12% with a volatility of 10%, versus a bond with an expected return of 5% but volatility of 3%. The former has a Sharpe ratio of 1.2, while the latter of 1.67, assuming a risk-free rate of 0%. The ratio provides a mathematical method to compare how different assets compensate the investor for the risk taken, making bonds and equities, or apples and oranges, more comparable. Correlation of returns and the efficient frontier. One of the key breakthroughs of modern portfolio theory was to show that a riskier asset can be added to a portfolio, and if its behavior differs significantly from the pre-existing assets in that portfolio, it can actually decrease the overall risk of the portfolio. How can a risky asset make a portfolio less risky? The key is correlation of returns. Correlation simply measures how assets move in relation to one another. The measurement ranges from a value of plus 1 to minus 1. If assets are perfectly positively correlated, then they move in tandem. If one is up 10%, the other is up 10% as well, for a score of plus 1. Similarly, if they are perfectly negatively correlated at minus 1, then when one is up 10%, the other will be down 10%. If there is zero correlation, then the assets are completely independent, and how one asset is behaving in the market has no bearing on the other. Stocks and bonds are often the major tools advisors and investors use to reduce risk as they try to build portfolios made up of assets with low correlations. Historically, stocks and bonds have moved differently from each other. When the economy is strong and stocks are generally rising, money flows out of bonds as investors fear they're missing out, causing bond prices to slump and stocks to go higher. Investors are alive and well with risk-on attitudes. When stock prices falter, investors become concerned by the potential losses, and money flows from stocks into the relative safety of bonds, known as a flight to safety. Such risk-off markets depress the price of stocks and float the price of bonds. The two assets move in different directions based on the same news. They act almost like two people on a seesaw. This historical balancing of risk between stocks and bonds should be done as precisely as possible. Otherwise, wild market swings one way or the other will have a painful impact on the innovative investor's portfolio. Combining assets that have a variety of correlations makes it possible to create a portfolio that can perform in both bull and bear markets. Just because a few players are feeling sick doesn't mean the whole team has to fail. One of the crown jewels of Markowitz's MPT was his concept of the efficient frontier, which indicates where a portfolio can provide the best expectation of return for its level of risk. The use of this concept is valuable for building portfolios because it helps to visualize how some groups of assets won't provide enough return for the risk taken. Within the financial services industry, people talk about risk in two ways, systematic and unsystematic. Systematic risk is the risk inherent to investing in assets subject to the effects of macroeconomic events, like global gross domestic product, GDP, growth, trade relations, warfare, and so on. It is also known as undiversifiable risk because all assets are affected by it. Unsystematic risk, on the other hand, is the risk specific to each individual investment, such as market sector, management, product expansion, geographic exposure, and so on. It is also known as firm-specific risk and can be neutralized with a smartly constructed portfolio. Unsystematic risk can be mitigated by constructing a portfolio of assets that neutralizes different firm-specific risks that could impact a portfolio. Ideally, the portfolio is crafted so that when one investment is negatively hurt by a specific event, another asset potentially could benefit by that very same event. For example, if a carbon tax is put on industry in the United States, then companies that are purely involved in oil and coal procurement may be adversely hit, while solar companies may jump. This carbon tax is not a systematic risk if it doesn't affect the market as a whole. Instead, it is an unsystematic risk that influences specific companies within the markets. In this case, The stocks of the oil company and the solar company would be examples of assets that experience negative correlation of returns to this event. What holds true for specific assets within the same asset class also holds true between the asset classes themselves. If unsystematic risk is fully neutralized by constructing a portfolio of assets and asset classes that have low to negative correlation of returns, then that portfolio will be exposed only to systematic risk. Modern portfolio theory takes it a step further by saying over the long term, investors are rewarded only for the systematic risk they take on and will be adversely affected over the long run if they leave themselves exposed to unsystematic risk. With the tools of MPT, it's possible to construct a portfolio that stays within an investor's risk profile while still generating returns sufficient to meet long-term financial goals and objectives. The innovative investor recognizes that the overall risk of his or her portfolio can be reduced by including assets that are uncorrelated to the traditional capital markets, such as Bitcoin and its digital siblings. Traditional asset allocation. For many years, traditional asset allocation models strictly focused on defining percentages of a portfolio in either stocks or bonds. For instance, the American Association of Individual Investors provides simplified models for three types of investors. Aggressive investors, 90% diversified stock and 10% fixed income. Moderate investors, 70% diversified stock and 30% fixed income. Conservative investors, 50% diversified stock and 50% fixed income. These three simple models can be used by people of different ages who have different investment time horizons. A whole host of equities can be included within diversified stock, and even more so for the variety of bonds that can be used for fixed income. For example, equities can be considered based on the size of the company, the growth characteristics, the valuation, the sector type, geographic exposure, and so on. Similarly, bonds can include government or corporate issues with varying durations, credit ratings, and tax advantages. This traditional approach to asset allocation ran aground in 2008 when the financial markets collapsed and investors found that even if they had both stocks and bonds in their portfolio, they all fell together. The average investor felt betrayed by the tried and trusted model of stocks and bonds moving in a non-correlated fashion. The crash of 2008 shook these investors from their economic lullaby. In an increasingly globalized world where capital market assets are more closely intertwined, it was becoming clear that 20th century diversification models wouldn't cut it for 21st century investing. While the crash of 2008 was felt by most everyone, it soon surfaced that some people had not only weathered the storm, but made significant money by leveraging the strong winds of fortune. Hedge fund managers who had been operating in relative secrecy were now being named as the new masters of the universe for their ability to avoid much of the damage of the crash, and for some, to profit greatly from it. The rise of alternative investments. The financial crisis of 2008 caused many financial advisors and wealth managers to evaluate different approaches to portfolio construction other than solely stocks and bonds. The returns seen by hedge funds during the crisis were identified as examples where non-traditional and alternative investment vehicles had provided positive, in some cases drastically so, performance returns. John Paulson became the face of hedge fund billionaires who benefited from the crisis when it was revealed that he had personally earned over $1 billion from his fund management, including the Paulson Advantage Plus Fund, an event-driven fund. This fund alone ranked number one over the period of 2006 to 2008, with an annualized return of nearly 63%. Equally successful was James Simon's Renaissance Technologies Medallion Fund, with a return of 80% in 2008. Becoming a hedge fund manager became all the rage for business-minded students, when it was revealed that the top 25 hedge fund managers had earned a total of $22.3 billion in 2007 and $11.6 billion in 2008. With numbers like these, the world of hedge funds caught the attention of the media. Investors questioned if these managers had something to do with the crash. They also wanted to know what they were doing differently and whether it was something they could do as well. First, let's understand what we mean by a hedge fund and how they differ among themselves. It's difficult to lump hedge funds together in one group, as they often have different investment objectives and approaches. Historically, one of the easiest ways to spot hedge funds has been their high fee structure. For example, many hedge funds operate under a 2-and-20 model, or sometimes 3-and-30, where they charge a 2% annual management fee and take 20% of the profits from a year. Other common characteristics include their exclusivity and general secrecy. Prior to the 2008 financial crisis, investors who took advantage of hedge fund performance and the alternative investments they utilized were typically of ultra-high net worth with sizable investable assets, given that often the minimum investment was $1 million or more to gain entry. Additionally, investors had to tie up their funds for lengthy periods as part of the agreement with the hedge fund manager. While mutual funds provide a prospectus that outlines exactly the approach and asset classes to be used, hedge funds are often veiled in secrecy. They might publicly advertise a broad investment strategy, but specifics are often withheld to preserve the secret sauce of the hedge fund. Hedge fund managers demand a high amount of flexibility and tolerance from their clients. For example, hedge fund managers could buy real estate or take ownership in what they believe to be an undervalued company, either publicly or privately held. If they believe upcoming political changes may favor oil, they could lease oil tankers or make a sizable investment in a foreign oil partnership. They can also utilize assets such as timber, short positions in stocks, meaning they're betting on the price falling, commodity derivatives, and yes, germane to this book, Bitcoin and other crypto assets. Even with this lack of transparency and liquidity, affluent investors rushed to hedge funds to chase the performance of managers like Paulson, Simons, and others. An underlying assumption for hedge fund investors was that they needed to be affluent enough to handle the high risk and volatile nature associated with a hedge fund manager's approach and fund assets. For the typical investor, the high asset commitments, illiquidity, and lack of transparency kept hedge funds beyond their reach. Fortunately, the underlying ability to utilize alternative investments in any portfolio is not as elusive as many are made to think. Alternative investments defined. So, how does one define an alternative investment? A search online and in dictionaries will present a reader with the perception that accurately defining the term is quite complicated due to the wide range of investments included, ranging from hedge funds to private equity to direct investments in natural resources like gold and timber. The reality is that classifying alternative investments can be a moving target as investment options and trends change over time. Many investors may already have alternative investment vehicles in their portfolio without specifically referring to them as such. An investment such as an exchange-traded fund, ETF, that specializes in arbitrage strategies or futures contracts may look like any other ETF in a portfolio, but it could be considered an alternative investment. Physical holdings in gold, silver, real estate, art collections, or personally owned businesses are all part of someone's net worth and could also be considered as alternative investments. A more current and concise way to describe an alternative investment is that it's an asset with its own unique economic and value-based characteristics that are separate from those of the primary investments of stocks and bonds. For an investor, the main concern is to have assets that perform in a non-correlated fashion to stocks and bonds, which have historically made up most investors' portfolio models, and many alternative assets fit that bill. If done properly, when the overall market has a severe meltdown, as happened in 2008, specific alternative investments within portfolios may not decrease. Equally, in market upturns, those same assets may or may not also increase in value. They may lose value, but such is the cost of overall risk reduction. As a small portion of the innovative investor's overall portfolio, alternatives are an effective way to balance risk and provide a cushion in the case of a stock or bond meltdown. Alternative investments and the innovative investor. Today's innovative investor can build an investment portfolio and asset allocation strategy with a clear understanding of risk and reward, and the inclusion of alternative investments can help. This has not been lost on wealth management firms that are now looking more aggressively into how alternative investments can be used to improve client returns. For example, Morgan Stanley has outlined asset allocation models for its high net worth investors with under $25 million in investable assets. Those models recommend 56% stocks, 19% bonds, 3% cash, and 22% alternatives. For those clients with over $25 million in investable assets, the recommendation is for 50% stocks, 19% bonds, 3% cash, and 28% in alternatives. Merrill Lynch has recommended allocation models for its typical client that include alternatives near or above 20% of a portfolio. Clearly, the inclusion of alternative investments should not be limited to only high net worth investors. Historically, one of the biggest reasons alternative investments have not been incorporated into retail portfolios is because of their illiquid characteristics. Many retail investors can't guarantee that they won't need to access their funds for 10 years, making many alternatives out of reach. That, however, is changing. Over the last decade, to address the need for alternative investment options as a way to provide diversification and non-correlation from the traditional capital markets, wealth management firms have been creating more investment options for the typical investor. The proliferation of ETFs has led to the creation of liquid investments in alternative assets, such as gold, energy resources, and real estate, as well as ways to play the volatility of the market. Because of the easy accessibility of these products through the capital markets, these vehicles and others have found their way into investors' portfolios and onto the recommended lists of many financial advisors. The impact of this is seen in a 2015 survey among financial advisors that found they had placed 73% of their clients in alternative investments, and that nearly three-quarters of advisors plan to maintain their current alternative investment allocations. The survey also showed that in terms of asset allocation, most advisors were recommending a range of 6% to 15% of a client's portfolio in alternatives. A smaller but not insignificant percentage of advisors recommended 16% to 25% of their clients' portfolios in alternatives. Bitcoin and other crypto assets are alternative assets that can be safely and successfully incorporated into well-diversified portfolios to meet these asset allocation recommendations. However, every alternative investment has its unique set of characteristics, and the innovative investor must understand these. The potential of Bitcoin and other crypto assets is so great that we believe they should be considered an asset class of their own. We can easily see them more and more commonly used in many innovative portfolios. We explain why we think crypto assets will increasingly be incorporated into mainstream retail portfolios, first starting with an exploration of how Bitcoin's risk, reward, and risk-reward profiles have evolved over the course of its life. Chapter 7. The most compelling alternative asset of the 21st century. Bitcoin is the most exciting alternative asset in the 21st century, and it has paved the way for its digital siblings to enjoy similar success. In this chapter, we dive into how Bitcoin evolved as an asset in the context of absolute returns, volatility, and correlations, concluding with how a small allocation of Bitcoin would have affected a portfolio over different holding periods. Because Bitcoin can claim the title of being the oldest crypto asset, giving us the most data to investigate its maturation, understanding its longitudinal market behavior will give us a window into how other crypto assets may evolve over time. Bitcoin's earliest pricing. Let's go back to the first time a price was established for Bitcoin, October 5, 2009, when it was priced at 1,309 Bitcoin to the dollar, or 0.07 of a cent per Bitcoin. A small website called the New Liberty Standard established the rate based on the amount of money it needed for electricity and rent to maintain the computer that mined Bitcoin, versus the amount of Bitcoin that had been reaped from so doing. If at that time an investor had tracked down one of the few Bitcoin miners in the world and offered $100 for the 130,900 Bitcoin implied by that exchange rate, by now that investor would have amassed over $100 million. A single $100 bill converted into 1 million $100 bills. It would have been one of the best investments of all time. However, having such impeccable timing is an elusive dream for investors. When I, Jack, began investigating Bitcoin in August 2013, Bitcoin was trading at $135. It had already appreciated significantly from the initial exchange rate of 1,309 Bitcoin to the dollar. Yet I decided it was not too late and ultimately made the investment. Similarly, I, Chris, didn't even consider investing in Bitcoin when I first heard about it in 2012. By the time I began considering Bitcoin for my portfolio in late 2014, the price was in the mid-300s, having increased 460,000-fold from the initial exchange rate. Like Jack, I also didn't think it was too late and made the jump. While the innovative investor may interpret the current price tag on Bitcoin as being too high, consider instead what can be done. We believe it's still early days for crypto assets. Absolute returns. To provide context for Bitcoin's behavior in the first 8 years of its life, we will compare it to other popular investments from both traditional and alternative asset classes. In terms of absolute returns, long-term comparisons between Bitcoin and many other assets make most jaws drop. But it's important to keep endpoint sensitivity in mind. Endpoint sensitivity refers to the starting and ending dates chosen for comparison, because over time, almost all assets fluctuate considerably in value. Choosing a low starting point and a high ending point will yield drastically different comparisons than a high starting point and low ending point. We have chosen January 3, 2017 as the ending point of analysis for this chapter, as that was Bitcoin's 8-year birthday. While designating a fixed endpoint, we have the flexibility to choose different starting points, including one of Bitcoin's most notable peaks in late 2013. By illustrating both high and low starting points, we are able to show the variety of experiences investors could have had depending on when they first bought Bitcoin. For those concerned with the cherry-picking of numbers, it should be noted that on January 3, 2017, the price of Bitcoin was around $1,000, whereas when this book was entering its final stages of editing, Bitcoin had risen past $3,000. We nonetheless have stuck with the $1,000 price of Bitcoin for the following comparison in pursuit of intellectual honesty. To begin with, we examine the longest-term Bitcoin prices we have that come from reliable exchange data. It assumes a $100 investment was made on July 19, 2010, a few days after Mt. Gox was officially open for business and providing the first widely used exchange services for Bitcoin. These broad market indices represent how the stock markets performed on average, with the S&P 500 representing approximately 80% coverage of available U.S. equity market capitalization, the DJIA for 30 of the largest U.S. stocks by market capitalization, and the NASDAQ 100 for big domestic and international companies in sectors that include computer hardware and software, telecommunications, and biotechnology. Since July 2010, the three broad indices have done well, with U.S. stocks in a recovery bull market after the financial crisis of 2008. An initial investment of $100 would have grown to $242, $231, and $291 for the S&P 500, DJIA, and NASDAQ 100 respectively. Although equity market returns have been respectable, they have been dwarfed by Bitcoin, which has done phenomenally in the same period. An initial investment of $100 grew to nearly $1.3 million by the beginning of January 2017. Linear versus logarithmic. Two types of scales are commonly used for representing the change in the price of assets: linear and logarithmic. Linear price scales show unadjusted unit changes in the y-axis. For example, if priced in dollars, $10 in value increase will look the same, whether the asset goes from $10 to $20 or $100 to $110. Logarithmic scales adjust the y-axis, in finance most commonly by factors of 10, which allows percent price increases to be compared. For example, on a logarithmic y-axis, the price move from $10 to $20 will show up more clearly than the move from $100 to $110, because the former represents a 100% price increase, while the latter is only a 10% price increase. What would look the same on a logarithmic scale, however, is a move from $10 to $20 and a move from $100 to $200. Logarithmic price scales are useful in comparing percent price changes over time, as well as compressing data of widely different values into one chart. We can also compare these indices to Bitcoin by calculating the compound annual growth rates, or the annual appreciation year over year. In this comparison, the post-crisis bull market performance is clear, as the S&P 500 provided nearly 15% compound annual returns, 50% better than the average 9.5% it provided investors in the 88 years between 1928 and 2016. In spite of the excellent performance of U.S. stock markets, Bitcoin was a clear standout in this 8-year period with compound annual returns of 332%. Rather than comparing Bitcoin to broad market indices, it may be more fair to compare it to high-growth companies riding similar waves of technological innovation. The FANG stocks of Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google have been the darling of many tech analysts over the last few years, outperforming the broad market indices and helping to reshape our increasingly digital world. However, even the FANG stocks were wildly outperformed by Bitcoin since Facebook's May 2012 initial public offering, IPO. An initial investment of $100 on the day Facebook completed its IPO would have turned into $306, $352, $1,276, and $262 for Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, respectively, by our end date of January 3, 2017. When matched up against these stellar tech names, Bitcoin has performed more than an order of magnitude better, with an initial investment of $100 growing to $20,133. On a relative basis, Bitcoin has provided capital appreciation 66-fold, 57-fold, 16-fold, and 77-fold, that of the FANG stocks respectively over this period. To provide better context and make the performance of the FANG stocks comparable to the performance of the broad market indices, we can once again convert the above returns into a compound annual rate. Doing so reveals that the FANG names have provided annual returns about double that of the broad market indices over the last few years, with Netflix as the standout for the group. Yet when compared with Bitcoin, every other investment pales. Remember that as of January 2017, Bitcoin's network value was 1/20th, 1/22nd, 1/3rd, and 1/33rd that of the FANG stocks respectively. Therefore, if Bitcoin is to grow to a similar size, much opportunity remains. Clearly, it's still early days for Bitcoin, and even earlier days for its digital siblings. We also added assets outside of U.S. equities, including U.S. bonds, U.S. real estate, gold, and oil. Gold and oil investors received a doubly short end of the stick, as by January 3, 2017, they had lost 30% and 40% of their value, respectively. All other assets provided positive returns since Facebook's IPO. At this point, innovative investors might ask, what if they didn't buy at Bitcoin's inception or at Facebook's IPO? Let's address this concern directly by going back to our prior discussion of endpoint sensitivity and seeing what would have happened if an investor had picked the worst time to buy Bitcoin, at the peak of its astronomical ascent in late 2013. Worst case scenario for absolute returns: buying at the top. In late 2013, Bitcoin's network value was over $10 billion, making it a significantly investable asset for retail investors, even by capital market standards. On November 29, 2013, Bitcoin reached $1,242, making one Bitcoin worth more than 1 ounce of gold. Clearly, Bitcoin had risen a long way from its humble roots. If innovative investors had bought at this peak price, their returns would not have been nearly as rosy as if they had bought when Mt. Gox launched or when Facebook IPO'd. In fact, they would have endured an 80% loss in value over the following year before Bitcoin bottomed in January 2015 and began a long, slow climb back to previous highs. By January 3, 2017, $100 invested in Bitcoin at its peak price would only retain $83, while an investment instrument based on the S&P 500, DJIA, or NASDAQ 100 indices would have grown to $133, $133, and $146, respectively. An investor who purchased Bitcoin at its peak on November 29, 2013, rather than one of the FANG stocks, would have suffered an even more drastic differential in returns. The capital appreciation provided by Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google would have been threefold, 2.3-fold, 2.9-fold, and 1.8-fold that of Bitcoin during this time period. While innovative investors who had gotten into Bitcoin soon after Facebook IPO'd would have been rewarded for their decision, if they had waited a year and a half, they would have been dealing with a vastly different story. At that same peak in price, innovative investors who chose Bitcoin over a non-equity holding, such as bonds, real estate, gold, or oil, would have been the most at peace with their decision. The performance of commodities like gold and oil had been far from stellar since November 2013, and in the period up to January 2017, Bitcoin actually outperformed oil. The low interest rate environment meant bonds conserved investors' capital, but didn't grow it much. In this group, U.S. real estate was the only investment that appreciated on par with the equity markets. At this point, we have provided insight into some of Bitcoin's best and worst returns in its relatively short life. However, throughout this book, we will be making the case that we believe there is much more price appreciation potential yet to come from both Bitcoin and select cryptocurrencies, crypto commodities, and crypto tokens. Dollar cost averaging is a means by which the innovative investor can avoid extreme sensitivity to the starting point of investing. As opposed to taking a big chunk of money and dumping it all into an investment at once, it often behooves the investor to average in, deploying capital at a measured cadence. In so doing, the investor may buy at the peak, but will also be buying all the way to the bottom, ultimately averaging a good price if the underlying investment has long-term potential for capital appreciation. Volatility. While absolute returns are often the topic of trending conversation, if unaccompanied by an investigation of volatility, investors may be overpaying in risk for their returns. Put another way, they may be undercompensated for the risk they're taking. In this sense, innovative investors must make sure they're being rewarded for the risk in their portfolio. Why crypto assets are typically volatile when first launched? Upon launch, crypto assets tend to be extremely volatile because they are thinly traded markets. A thin market refers to the size of the order book, and an order book refers to the list of buys and sells on an exchange. In other words, it's a measure of the number of people wanting to buy and sell at any given moment. Each order is one row in an order book, and so the more orders there are, the thicker the book. If there aren't many buys and sells, then the order book is thin. That said, some orders also need to be of sizable amounts. If all the orders consist of bids to buy or sell $1 of the asset, then it doesn't matter how many orders there are, it will still be a thin order book. The thinness of the order book is also referred to as the liquidity of the market. If the market is highly liquid, then there are lots of orders and many of them are likely large. In this case, value can be traded easily. If the market is illiquid or thin, then sizable price swings with low volume will occur because someone trying to buy or sell a lot of the asset will fill all the available sell or buy orders, which drives the price up or down. As a result, in thin or illiquid markets, when investors are bullish, they can drive massive swings to the upside, just as when investors turn bearish. Strong selling volume can quickly drive the price down. When crypto assets are first launched, they have relatively thin order books because the investor base is typically smaller, trading is more infrequent, and orders may be small. This can create volatility in the price of the new asset. However, as news of the asset's merit spreads, interest will increase along with trading volume. The order book will typically fatten and volatility will often decrease. One of the easiest ways to visualize the volatility of an asset is to see how much its price changes day to day, or in other words, the daily percent price changes. The bigger the daily percent price changes are, the more volatile the asset is. Early in Bitcoin's history, there were frequent earthquakes, with the price moving more than 50% in a day. Over time, however, the Bitcoin seismometer has registered smaller and smaller earthquakes in Bitcoin's price. Bitcoin has become more popular and therefore more widely traded, so its market has become more liquid. Therefore, when lots of people choose to buy or sell, the market is able to absorb these changes much more smoothly. Even though Bitcoin's daily percent price changes have decreased dramatically over the years, bringing it into the range of many small capitalization growth stocks, it is still a volatile asset. Compare the fluctuation of Bitcoin's daily percent price changes in 2016 with that of Twitter and a market stalwart like AT&T. Twitter experienced 3 days in 2016 when its price dropped more than 15%, and one day where it jumped more than 20%. Bitcoin had only 2 days where its price increased more than 10%, and only one day where it dropped more than 15%. AT&T, the slow and steady line in the middle, is a $250 billion company that lumbers along with hardly any price movement. Volatility is most commonly derived by taking the standard deviation of the daily percent price changes. The bigger this number is, the more the investor can expect significant swings in the price of the asset they're holding, and therefore, the riskier the asset is. Twitter was 50% more volatile than Bitcoin in 2016, and Bitcoin was nearly 3 times more volatile than AT&T. The latter is to be expected given Bitcoin's network value is less than 5% that of AT&T's market cap, and it has been around for less than a decade, while AT&T has been around for more than a century. In examining FANG stocks, we see an interesting pattern with volatility. Remembering our discussion of modern portfolio theory, historically the most volatile assets have generally been the ones with the greatest returns. This relationship between risk, that is, volatility, and reward is to be expected. No reward without the accompanying risk. Bitcoin's volatility has been the highest, with Netflix coming in second, and these two assets were the best performing. Interestingly, in this period, Bitcoin's annual returns of 212% were threefold that of Netflix's 73%, yet Bitcoin's volatility was only 35% greater than Netflix. Intuitively, it appears Bitcoin has had better risk-reward characteristics than Netflix.